In this week's programme, the governance of the Catholic Church. In her book Quo Vadis, former President Mary McAleese argues that despite the Second Vatican Council's insistence on a greater role for the bishops of the world in running the Church, control is still mainly in the hands of the Pope and his curia, or civil service. The style of governance, 50 years after Vatican II, is still monarchical rather than collegial. With the arrival of Pope Francis, that style of governance may be about to change. For example, two of the most respected of Vatican analysts, Marco Politi of La Repubblica and Robert Mickens of the Tablet, predict that this new pontiff will want to collaborate much more with his fellow bishops. This evening's discussion of Mary McAleese's book was recorded before the departure of Benedict and the arrival of his successor. Taking part in our conversation were Enda McDonough, Professor Emeritus of Moral Theology at Maynooth, who also trained as a canon lawyer. Fionnuala Kennedy is an economist and author of a biography of Frank Duff, founder of the Legion of Mary. Patsy McGarry is religious affairs correspondent of the Irish Times. First, Patsy's assessment of Mary McAleese's book.
Well, speaking as a layman, it is not meant for the laity, or for the lay person, really, Andy. It is very much an academic work, the work of a lawyer, a canon lawyer. It is, as she makes clear herself, based on her own master's thesis prepared following her study in Milltown College. And the first three chapters in particular reflect that. It is highly academic, very referential in the academic style, and it is written for that particular audience. For me, the chapter that meant most was the final chapter, where she really takes the gloves off and speaks in her own voice on the basis of what she's already concluded from the previous three chapters, where basically she makes the point that the College of Bishops has really had no role in the Church. It hasn't met since 1965. It has been sidelined effectively by the papacy. She makes the point in the book that really nothing has changed in Church governance since Vatican II, that really is the Pope and the Curia who run everything. And it is, if you like, a call to arms on the part of the clergy, of the laity, and indeed the lower clergy as well.
Fionnuala Kennedy, your reaction to it?
I agree with Andy that the most compelling part of the book really is what I would describe as a work from the heart. And I think that those of us who've the good fortune to have met Mary McAleese realise what a warm-hearted woman she is. And it's a very passionate book in many ways. At an intellectual level, I found it quite a puzzling book because, in a certain sense, her heart's desire is not to be found in canon law. She's looking for something that really isn't there. I mean, we get more than halfway through the book, I think it's page 84, before we're told that collegiality isn't actually mentioned in the Code of Canon Law. So in a certain sense, the title itself is intriguing, that it's on a topic, collegiality in the Code of Canon Law, when the author knows that collegiality is not mentioned in the Code of Canon Law. Now, it's mentioned in John Paul II's introduction, which is quite a separate matter. So in a certain sense, she's looking for something which she knows isn't there. And I think a real practical issue arises, which John O'Malley, in his great book on what happened at Vatican II, poses. He says that at the end of Vatican II, that there was no clarity as to how collegiality was to be inserted into the social reality of the Church. And Mary McAleese herself, in her concluding chapter, says, you know, my book isn't the place to look for this, but this is really the critical question, because it's an almost impractical concept to know how do you insert 4,000 bishops into decision making.
What do you think essentially she's saying at the end of the day? What is she saying, do you think?
Well, I think she's saying that the type of governance which she would like to see in the Catholic Church, which is somehow a democratic form of governance, and that's giving democracy its good face, because democracy is a very imperfect form of government also.
But giving a voice to the bishops, though, sounds reasonable enough, doesn't it?
Well, I would think that if the bishops are doing their job in their diocese, that they've plenty to be going on with. And it's very hard to see what precisely she wants to involve them in. We have had developments.
Do you agree with her broad thrust, you know, with where she's coming from in terms of governance?
Well, I can't say that she's made a case which intellectually convinces me.
OK, Enda McDonough, your reaction to the book.
Well, I think it's, as both of our contributors have said, it is a very academic piece of work up to chapter 4, the very last chapter. As an academic piece of work, it seems to me to take on an almost impossible task. Mm-hmm. From the title she gave herself that Fionnuala mentioned, you know, the Quo Vadis about where does the church go, or, you know, as taken from the legendary meeting of Peter and Christ, and collegiality in the code, which where it doesn't exist, is a very tricky business. But I suppose her strength is that she examines the detail of the law, which was the new law, which, as introduced by the Pope at the time, said it was rooted in the collegiality that emerged at Vatican II.
But isn't the problem, Enda, was that there was a great deal of ambiguity as to what collegiality meant?
Enormous, yeah, you know, and still is.
Yes.
And you wouldn't know from actually reading the book and still what it meant. All you would know is that the constitution of the church is composed of a double leadership of either the Pope on his own or the Pope in the College of Bishops or the College of Bishops with the Pope. Now, that's a very difficult idea to master. And it doesn't seem to me that the detail which emerges in the code itself and which she examines very carefully takes us out of any
of the... But surely she's right in saying that the code can't improve on what happened at the council. It really can't better it.
No, and what happened at the council wasn't adequate.
So that's the key. In other words, it's the council itself, the confusion, the code of canon law can do no better than that. The thing that strikes me is that at the heart of this seems to be that the church before the Vatican II was very clearly a church top-down, run by the Pope and the Curia. After the Vatican Council, in theory at least, we were to move away from that, giving a greater say to the bishops, Fionnuala. And that doesn't seem to have happened. I mean, the impression today is that it's run from the centre very much.
I think an aspect which may be missing from the discussion is a realisation that we're talking about the Roman Church. We're talking about the Latin Rite.
Yes.
And the Code of Canon Law refers to the Roman Rite. And if we were to look at the Orthodox Catholic Church...
I'm happy to go that direction. But for the moment, we have enough on our plate in looking at say, you know, the governance of the church that
Well, I think, Andy, it's important because the Melkites played an important part at Vatican II.
Okay, fair enough.
And they insisted on speaking French. And it caused quite a stir.
But Fionnuala, I think this is muddying the water. Patsy, I want you to...
Fionnuala made the point that the collegiality is not discussed at all in the 1983 code. Yet that code, or an excerpt from that code, is the very foundation of this book. Whereas, and she quotes it, Canon 212. And I'll read the final canon there, number 3. According to the knowledge, competence and prestige which they possess, this is members of the laity, they have the right and even at times the duty to manifest to the sacred pastors their opinion on matters which pertain to the good of the church and to make their opinion known to the rest of the Christian faithful without prejudice to the integrity of faith and morals with reverence toward their pastors and attentive to common advantage and the dignity of persons. And that is what she's trying to do in this book, is to make known the opinion of the laity to the senior clergy in the church.
But first the bishops. To Rome, I mean, the problem is the church isn't run by the bishops. I mean, the laity, that's another day's work, Enda.
But yeah, well, yes. Two points seem to me to be important that she brings up. One is, it was raised at the council and, you know, collegiality did at least implicitly figure quite a bit, and councils were sort of taken then to be expressions of collegiality, although that wasn't the history of their thing. But the two big moves that seem to me to have failed in order to take forward the sense of collegiality was, one, the failure of the Synod of Bishops, which was, after all, introduced as some stage in the development of collegiality.
By Paul VI.
By Paul VI, and mentioned in the same tone by his successors. But in fact, it has failed.
It's not a decision-making body. I mean, isn't
it? No,
you and I discussed that, Philola, in the Father O'Malley book.
Yeah. That's
the fact
right.
that Paul VI, yes. I mean, yeah. there was suggestion that he almost slipped it in, although it's quite unfair, obviously, to Paul VI. But there is the idea that the Synod came in without teeth, and this was the body. I mean, the question may be asked, why did you not have a forum after the Council to give expression to what had been agreed?
Well, Paul VI, whether he was doing it... to help the cause or to hinder it, anticipated the bishops introducing some idea of a forum or synod of bishops. And it never really happened. Took off the ground. And that was partnered by the failure that was promised, the failure to reform the Curia.
It's interesting that...
These two, I think, simply paralysed progress.
But the present Pope, former Cardinal Ratzinger, as he then was, in... Church ecumenism and politics is strongly opposed to decision making by the Synod of Bishops. He says it would amount to a second Curia. So that, in fact, what Benedict did in the past, what he said, is reinforcing the notion of the Synod as a non-decision making body.
Andy, the point that I was trying to make, and the reason why it's terribly relevant to our discussion, is that the Eastern Church, which had patriarchs or has patriarchs and is much more collegial and goes back more to the earlier church, didn't have to cope with the Reformation. And I think that the Reformation is the key to the centralisation in the Roman Catholic Church, that the Melkite Church or the Orthodox Church has the great patriarchs of Antioch, Alexandria and Jerusalem. And it is a more collegial church. But if you've had to cope with the Reformation splintering, that's really the point that I was trying to make.
It makes a lot of sense.
And I think that you always, you know, if there's a question of authority, I'm sure it's true in RTE as in other institutions, there's a clampdown and there's extra discipline as an antidote to fracturing and fissuring. And I think, you know, as Newman said, God made history to be doctrine. I think we cannot take the Roman Church out of its historical context.
Yes, what you're saying makes complete sense, because one of the great arguments in favour of centralisation is the desire to protect unity. Clearly, that's the only argument, in fact, in favour of it.
You could have very different forms of unity.
Unity, yes.
With diversity and so on. But it was true, as it were, strengthened, Fanola's point. It was also... began to surface with the recent division, say, within the Church of England, that this also frightened them. Even though many bishops who were supporting ecumenism really thought that you couldn't have any serious or close interchurch relations without some devolving of papal authority. There would have to be some kind of collegial government with the Pope, not necessarily under the Pope.
The point about all of this, Andy, is that it almost is peripheral to what's happening in the real world today, and that, in fact, those very structures, that centralisation of authority in the Church, is detrimental to the future of the Church. And this is the point she makes again and again in the book.
But how do you mean marginal? Surely it's central. Surely
Andy,
what we're
the faithful
unfolding.
Are drifting away. The faithful do not accept it. She points out, for instance, in the book, in the earlier part of the 20th century, less than 10% of the nation of the world were democracies. Today, that figure is closer to 65%. People expect to participate in decision making which affects their lives, whatever the central authorities in the Church think today. Now, she also makes the point that the Synod of Bishops purely has an advisory role in fact, that the ad limina visits of the various bishops' conferences to Rome are pro forma and really have no significance, and if they had, that the child abuse issue would have been addressed much more effectively and sooner by Rome itself, and that the episcopal conferences themselves, though they have authority to introduce...
Are you saying it's the whole church thing is falling apart anyway?
I'm saying her point is that the current structures are untenable if the church is to have a future in the modern world.
But
that meet the needs of the modern faithful.
Well, I think that's... certainly a very reasonable point. The kind of balance to that, I suppose, is partly the fear of further disintegration and more rapid disbandment of the regular church, and further that Ursi, for example, whom she quotes favourably, says, well, this is sowing the seed. Collegiality although this is arguable, is a whole new concept, at least for the contemporary church and the contemporary bishops and the contemporary popes. Although a number of people would say it's a renewal, a revival of something that characterized the earlier church, perhaps pre-Reformation, as Fanon said. But that seed, he thinks, will grow. Now, that's a possibility.
The thing that strikes me, Fanola, is that governance is a dead duck as far as the public is concerned. People have no interest in it. When Mary McAleese was interviewed by Pat Kenny, and a very good interview by Gay Byrne on television, the follow-up had to do more or less what she had to say about homosexuality. There was no interest in what she had to say about governance. It's not, in common parlance, a sexy subject. So why is that? Or is it that and it's obviously it's extremely important who runs the show, but people don't seem to care.
Well, perhaps, Andy, the people have a great wisdom, and that the church, that we've had too much emphasis on who wields the power and who governs, and that it should be followed.
But it is important, Fanola.
Of course it is important, but the way Christ governed was through service. And I think that John Paul II used that wonderful phrase, the authority of service. And I think we've forgotten about that. And I think that there's nothing stopping lay people from serving their neighbour in a Christian way.
I think that is highly laudable, eminently desirable, but I think it may never touch the kind of governance that ensures that a particular view of reality, a particular view of the world, a particular view of the church.
She makes the point, Andy, that today the church is dealing with an educated laity at a level it never had to do previously in its 2,000 years. Mm. That laity is demanding a role. Mm. That laity has views. She refers to a poll conducted by the Association of Catholic Priests in February of last year, which found that 87% of Irish Catholics do not believe that celibacy should be mandatory for priests. 77% of Irish Catholics believe that there should be women priests. 61% of Catholics disagree with the Church's current teaching on homosexuality. She's coming at this from a democratic point of view, and that this view, this sense of fidelity should be expressed in the teachings of the church.
If there's resistance to episcopal collegiality, what chance have the laity got?
Well, what the laity are doing is they're walking away.
Going their own way. Hmm. What do you think of that, Enda?
Yes, I'm afraid that a lot of that is true. The difficulty about a book like this is the theology that it might try to protect or express is not sufficiently developed. And the theology goes back to dealing with the mystery of human existence, the human being, the mystery of Christ, and so on. And that has not been adequately developed in the kind of world that she's talking about, Patsy's talking about, that Fanola and yourself have mentioned, that sense of mystery has to be expanded into much more human language and practice. So what you need is a further exploration of the mystery of the authority in the church. And what you need in relation to that is, of course, experimental practice. You're not going to have a development in the living of Christianity or in the authoritative structures of the communion or community of Christians without a certain freedom of experimentation. And that seems anathema
and expression
the Roman authorities.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's, as far as the theology is concerned, surely there was an attempt at conceptual clarification at the council as to what collegiality meant. My question is, and that was left ambiguous. Mm. It wasn't clear. No. Therefore, when the canon law came along, canon law, they could do nothing. The question is, if you applied the cui bono test here to that, to the existence of ambiguity, the lack of clarity, who benefits? In whose benefit? Let's take a simple universe of reformers and people who want to hold the line. Who benefits, Patsy? Yeah.
It's
by
clear,
the ambiguity.
Andy, it's very clear who benefits. It's the authorities in Rome. Nothing, as she points out in the book, nothing has changed where governance in Rome is concerned. So where there's ambiguity, they can exploit it because they're the powerful people. They're in a position to do so. they can use the ambiguity towards their own ends, and that has been the pattern
but
for the last 50
years. But surely these people aren't all power mad. Surely, and the people that are criticised all the time in the Vatican are trying to do good and see the world in that particular way.
I'm sure there are many, but on the other hand, they're caught in a system and an ideology which suggests if we let go, if we give that kind of freedom, allow that kind of experimentation, the church will disintegrate. They're trapped in that kind of mentality. Yeah. Often good people, mainly men, I'm afraid, but often good people, but they're trapped. And I think this is, they're not going to be released by, upper...
I mean,
people.
I see a kind of death of theology going on in our time, Finola, in the sense that what you're getting from the centre are people who are apologists for a particular line. There's a certain dying of thought as a result of that. Would you agree or not?
Killing of thought.
Killing of thought.
Well, I perhaps have a much simpler view of the theology of the Church. And there's a mystery for me in Mary McAleese's use of Quo Vadis, because right at the end of the book she says that this was something that Christ said to Peter and that it changed the course of history. But in fact, and this is crucial to my understanding of the Church, it's in St. John's Gospel, Peter asked Christ, Quo Vadis Domine, and Jesus replied, I'm going to a place, where you can't follow me, and he foretells the denial of Peter, who was the first pope. And then in the apocryphal letter of St. Peter, there's this famous scene, which is the scene of that famous painting by Carracci, Quo Vadis Domine, when Peter is fleeing from possible death in Rome, and he meets the risen Lord after the resurrection. And Jesus says to him, I am going to Rome to be crucified a second time, Romum Vadum, Iterum Crucifigi. And in that, he is saying to Peter, I am going to be crucified a second time in you. And then Peter gains courage instead of fleeing in terror and goes back to Rome and is crucified. And that, to me, is the theology of the Church, that Christ is in the individual Christian member, a cell in this body of Christ. And this is how, what you do to the least of my brethren, you do to me. This is as far removed from questions of governance and who rules
But it is an institution, but you can't. I know I've always sensed, Finola, you'd like to move away. You feel governance is irrelevant, but at the end of the day, that's the world we live in, a world of institutions that are managed and so on. End of.
Well, I was just thinking of the gospel, or rather the quotation we had last Sunday from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians about our being members of the body. And this is completely lost, it seems to me, in our trying to develop a theology of the institution. It is, in the deepest Christian sense, the body of Christ. And we are all fully members of the body of Christ. And we can't...
But the problem is you could articulate that kind of theology and still have it side by side with an institution that was extremely unjust and unfair.
Yeah, well, of course. Well, when it's unjust and unfair, it's really ignoring that theology and the implications of it.
And we know...
And
we know, indeed we know, how unjust and unfair it can be in this country in the way it has treated certain priests in Ireland, in the way that Father Tony Flannery more immediately, Father Sean Fagan, Father Ona Sullivan, Father Brian Darcy and others have been dealt with, where they've been silenced, their conscience has been attempted to be neutered because they disagree with some of the lesser, if you like, teaching principles of the Church.
Another Pauline phrase occurred to me in the recent row is that Christ was in the world reconciling, God was in Christ reconciling the world with himself. I don't see any practice of reconciliation in these disputes. Now, in the civil law, for example, the practice of mediation has developed enormously in order to get out of some of the tangles of legal disputes and so on. But we don't seem to have anything of that kind in the Church. And that hasn't, in the decade before the council, some of the best theologians in the world were under censure. Karl Rahner, J. John Courtney Murray, Yves Congar, Henri de Lubac, and so on. Yet they turned out to be giants at the council. Now, we've gone back from that, you know.
Finola, let's say you want
to... Oh, I agree completely with Enda. And I think that, again, if you look at the span of history, I mean, you recall that Newman was delated to Rome for heresy. Now he is, you know, the great figure who brooded over Vatican II. And I agree utterly with Enda that there must be a human way of dealing with people who have differing views within the church. And I don't think the truth is served by clamping down on debate. Not for one instant do I mean to say that. I think that there must be utter respect for opposing points of view, even if in the end it only strengthens one's initial conviction. But I think that one must always be open and always be receptive. And things do change. And I think Enda's quoted that wonderful man, Ladislas Orsi, who talks about the slow burn of Vatican II. Now, in fact, Mary McAleese isn't as positive about him. She quotes Nicholas Lash, yes, the emeritus professor in Cambridge, as somebody whose view she would be more closer to espousing. And she's a little dismissive of the slow burn. And I think that we
depends
just have
what you mean by slow burn.
He's talking about centuries.
100, 500 years.
He's talking centuries.
I know, but we just have to perhaps be patient and believe that, you know, the truth will come out and that rightness and goodness will be vindicated.
We've been discussing Quo Vadis, Collegiality in the Code of Canon Law by Mary McAleese, published by Colombo Press. My thanks to Finola Kennedy, Patsy McGarry and Enda McDonough. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.